This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
You know, you've got this lemonade, an alcoholic drink with a poison in it, coming through the funnel first, and then from like a bird's eye point of view, just seeing this red shoot up as well as I'm being poisoned. That was quite quite harrowing, and I'm not surprised that they decided to go with a slightly less shocking one, but still shocking nonetheless.
Hello and welcome to Black Mirror Cracked, the podcast for all your Black Mirror needs. My name's Sachandrika and I'll be your host. Today we'll be talking about the Season 2 episode White Christmas. It's the first time that Black Mirror has had an episode with three stories in it that kind of build up to an ending, and we see it again in Season 4 with Black Museum. Today on the podcast we'll have showbiz journalist Vicky Newman coming in to talk to me about the episode. We'll also be welcoming Rasmus Hardiker, who plays the ill-fated Harry in the first story of the episode. Harry just wanted a date, but ended up with a funnel full of something instead. Vicky Newman.
Hi.
What do you do, Vicky Newman?
I'm a showbiz reporter for Mirror Online.
Vicky's one of my colleagues. And so is White Christmas up there with some of your favourite Black Mirror episodes?
It really is. I love White Christmas. And it's a lot darker though, isn't it? It's kind of, a lot of them are sort of like fun and upbeat, although they send a strong message. White Christmas is really kind of haunting in a way. So it's really different, but I do very much enjoy it.
What do you like about it?
I think I love this kind of futuristic feel to Black Mirror in general, and the way that he kind Charlie Brooker kind of sort of comments on where he thinks things are going to go and everything. And with White Christmas, it's not as much as episodes like Nosedive, which we've just talked about, but it does have this sort of social media element to it that you can block people. So, you know, like you get an annoying phone call from a call centre. First thing you do, you come off, you block the number, don't you? And this is, you can actually block people in real life.
It's funny you say phone calls because Twitter blocking came to mind when I saw it. So there's really? So many different ways of blocking.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, obviously with social media and stuff, like someone on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or whatever who you don't like, they're annoying you. You block them. They can't contact you. And it's that kind of idea, isn't it? But this is real life. So if I wanted, I'd block you and I wouldn't be able to see you and you couldn't see me.
Thinking about Nosedive, which is the most social and everyone's interconnected all the time. And White Christmas is about isolation and being pushed out of someone's life, actually.
Yeah.
My name is Rasmus Hardiker and I played Harry in Black Mirror White Christmas. So when I got the script, I mean, you know, it was quite a while ago now. We did it in 2014, I believe. I was just instantly sort of wowed by how scary the whole thing was and how close to realism it is. So it was a must for me.
It is not one of the most technologically advanced of the Black Mirror ones, and it's actually almost close to like a sitcom. Like when people get things wrong. How did you feel when you first read it? Did you get the whole script or just your story?
Yeah, we got the whole script, and like I said, just reading through it from memory, I was just excited really and really impressed at the writing. And this was my first foray into Black Mirror, so I didn't know what to expect, but I'd heard great things, and it absolutely lived up to it. I was very impressed by the writing.
In terms of being on set, obviously it goes from being quite like playful and a bit strange with all the voices in the head, which is something Charlie Brooker returns to, certainly like Black Museum.
And then having this really intense scene from your perspective. What was that like on set?
It was great on set. Despite the sort of dark nature of it, we had a lot of fun. Carl Tibbetts, who directed, was a brilliant director, and Charlie Brooker was on set. And we just kind of had fun in this really harrowing moment, especially at the end when Harry is poisoned. There was a couple of different versions of that. And I remember one having like a blood capsule already in my mouth, so that when Natalia's character was pouring the drink into my mouth, there originally would have been a lot more blood to come up through the funnel, but on playback it was deemed a little bit too much, so toned it down somewhat. But yeah, we had a good time.
When you sort of saw the twist in the script, what was that like? Was it easy to imagine it, or was it really something that came together on set when you were acting a lot more?
I think because the writing was so solid, there was very little room for doubt in it. So, I mean, it did come together from memory again on the page. But as is always the case, I mean, it's only really realised when you are on set filming it, and you just realise quite how impactful each of these stories are.
What do you think of that three-part structure? It was kind of the first time they tried it out with White Christmas, and they've gone back to it. And I think that it can be really effective, because you learn kind of how the technologies come together and how people are using it. What did you think of it?
Well, I really liked it, because, I mean, just, you know, let's say from an audience's point of view, three different stories, it's keeping you occupied and captivated. Even though there's sort of each story's end is sort of chopped off quite abruptly, and I think that leaves you with more like I think cliffhangers are pretty big these days, so I mean it's I think it was definitely a good thing.
How else do you think that story could have gone? Do you think Harry could have done anything to have saved himself, because that's what everyone wants when they watch it? They want some way out for him.
It's funny, everybody that says it just says, oh no, it was horrible, in a fantastic way, of course. No, I don't think there is. I just think he was an unfortunate victim of circumstance, and, you know, he was a nice guy, nervous, you know, taking bad advice, and it went horribly wrong, and I don't see any other way out of it, because he wasn't to know that she had these problems and wanted to commit suicide.
Yeah, it does feel inevitable once it starts happening with the funnel, once like it clicks for everyone. it's such great writing, I think, for us to not click up until then. But on the set, did you have to do any kind of acting on your own, like talking to these voices, to all the peanut gallery, as I like to call them?
That's right, yeah. That was all shot separately, so it was all sort of me reacting and talking to myself. All of it was done separately. I mean, there's always something whenever you're dealing with special effects, be it audio or green screen, that you, let's say if there's a dragon or a monster that's attacking you, you oftentimes look at a silver ball for, you know, the visual effects stuff. So no, I'd done that sort of thing before. And I do a lot of voices for animation. So I'm constantly sort of playing to myself, if that makes sense.
With working with John Hamm, did you meet him before you started working together? Or were you kind of in different rooms recording at different times?
Yeah, totally different rooms. It was like I said, it was just the peanut gallery, and him had totally different schedules to mine. So it was all kind of completely unknown how it would look until it sort of came together.
And did you get a chance to see it before it went out? It would have gone out on Channel 4, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I didn't actually. I think I watched it with the rest of Britain when it came out. I believe it was Christmas Eve, was it, or around that time?
Yeah, it feels about 2014, wasn't it? Yeah, I think.
Yeah, so when we filmed it, yeah, you'll have to excuse my memory. No, I watched it on telly.
Is it a kind of an experience that sticks out in your mind in terms of your career?
It is, yeah. I mean, Black Mirror was on, and then it went away, and then White Christmas came back a couple of years after, I believe, the hiatus was. And that sort of really sparked the new series. I remember just being in London working and then and having a lunch break and seeing Carl Tibbetts, the director, and he said, "Oh yeah, they've commissioned a whole new season in the States." And I think it was that that really reignited it and kicked it off. So it's a huge thing for me, really, not only to be a part of it and have a lot of fun doing it, but a lot of people sort of approach me and commend me on the episode and ask me what it was like. And I'm just really pleased that people dug it, you know, because we did. We really had a good time doing it and loved watching it, to be honest.
What was the conversation like with, I guess, your partner in the scene, Natalia Tenner? How did you both kind of approach how you're going to do this and what was the working relationship like? Because I think it actually needs a lot of trust to then misunderstand each other so wildly.
Yes. I mean, well, that's the thing that you want the, as you mentioned earlier, you want the rug pulled out from the audience. So as little inkling as you have beforehand, and as sweet as those two characters are to you, the less you expect it, which is exactly what Charlie wanted, you know. But as far as a working relationship, Natalia and I had known each other for about 10 years. We did a film in Italy with the late, great John Hurt called Lecture 21. So we were in Italy for a good couple of months, and we got to be really good friends and kept in touch. So it was completely effortless as far as the two of us were concerned and our chemistry.
In terms of Charlie Brooker's involvement, was he on set quite a lot? Was he rewriting lines, or is it kind of, here's the script, you go with it and make changes? Or how does that work?
Well, he was on set the whole time, very approachable, and we had a really good laugh. He's a great guy, very creative, and open to suggestions and improv. There was in the party scene, there was a lot of improv going on. Same with our director. Everyone was just kind of open to improv, which I love doing. I think, you know, each individual performer brings something, so why not, you know, give them the ball, see what they do. But in terms of anything major, it would have just been sort of funny stuff really at the party that would have been improv. Anything major was already there, because like I said, if the writing is absolutely on point, which it was, then it was just pretty much scripted. I'm sure he changed, you know, tweaked a few lines here and there, but it was all as it was when I got the script, I believe. Like I said, the sort of the more light and free and innocent that the first part of that story was, the more impactful that last 2 minute twist, I think it was like a couple of minutes before the end, that really has, it just takes such a dark turn very quickly and people don't really see it coming. I mean, if you can improv and be light with it, and I think it just adds to the whole the downfall, really.
How long did filming that scene actually take, or how long did it feel like?
It was, I believe it was half a day. It was not so much the mindset or anything like that, because, you know, I trusted Natalia and vice versa. It was more having lemonade poured down your throat was a little bit kind of eye-watering at times, but it was so worth it just to go and look at the playback. The one instance where I had a blood capsule as well, I remember watching the playback on scene and everybody winced. You know, you've got this lemonade, an alcoholic drink with a poison in it, coming through the funnel first, and then from like a bird's eye point of view, just seeing this red shoot up as well as I'm being poisoned. That was quite harrowing, and I'm not surprised that they decided to go with a slightly less shocking one, but still shocking nonetheless. We did various setups, and one particular one, if memory serves, was rigged directly above me, or it could have been handheld, I really can't remember, but it was a complete bird's eye view. And I think I remember the shot that you're talking about, actually, where you see my point of view and part of the funnel.
Yeah, just because it makes you feel as trapped as Harry. Yeah,
that's right, yeah. I believe the funnel was placed just above the camera that had that would have had some sort of protection over it to protect the lens and the electronics. And then I think a pump would have blasted some of it out. So I was standing by the side giving Natalia her lines off, and she would have been just acting to the bottom of the camera, the funnel.
It takes such an imagination to come up with something like this, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Yeah, he's a frightening, frightening individual. He's a genius. He's an absolute genius.
What do you think of the rest of the episode then? Because it's very much about crime and punishment and what do people deserve?
Well, I think I thought it was brilliant. I was captivated throughout. I really did. And I loved the three-pronged storyline. I think John Hamm is fantastic. Rafe Spall, I'd known for many, many years. We did National Youth Theatre together. And I did my very first job with him, which was a show called The Rotters Club, in 2004. So, yeah, we go back a long way as well. So, again, small world. So it was just nice to see my friends and nice to see a really brilliantly put together show. And each storyline was excellent and harrowing. And with the little girl, it was, fantastic. I'm going to go and rewatch it now, actually.
Then we go to the second one, which is like, well, the day job. And do we think he's earning Joe's trust by revealing the ugly parts of himself?
That does seem what he was trying to do. But again, you don't really realise that until the end. And at first, you know, as far as you know, these guys have been working together for 5 years. They're in this anonymous bunker in the middle of nowhere. There's no one else there. And it's just, he's so desperate for a bit of companionship that he's kind of just deciding, like, open up and about me life. And he's just kind of spilling out all this stuff. But he is being selective in what he does and doesn't tell him. And
can I just add one thing? That he's selective in what he says to Joe, but we see through Matt Trent's eyes.
Yeah.
Like his creepy dudes, and we see the truth.
Yeah.
So it's also a kind of filming trope as well, that there's so much editing that goes into any TV show, any film, that tricks you into thinking time has passed, or all these tricks that are played on the characters. But we see through Matt Trent's eyes and see the truth of what he did the moment he realised that Harry was not going to survive this encounter.
True, yeah.
And so we've kind of got, through the medium of TV and film, we've got a view through his eyes and see the truth. And that's quite interesting. So the idea of making something into art, I guess, also gives us a said eye.
I mean, yeah, we're in a privileged position as a viewer because we're sort of getting a lot more of the picture than Joe is. And obviously he's hearing this story and he doesn't know the full story. He doesn't know that there was this involvement. As far as he knows, it was just Matt and the guy. I don't think he even knew about the other people, did he?
No, I don't think he mentions them.
He just is a dating guru who's just doing this advice. He doesn't even know about this, like, sort of ring.
The Rogues Gallery,
So,
but we get to see it.
So it's interesting that he's shown an edited version of himself to this guy to try and get him to open up. And then
in Joseph Callister, he takes people's DNA without the consent. And so that's where this has been taken to a ridiculous extent. And actually, this cookie doesn't show up in the Black Museum, but Robert Daly's DNA extractor does.
Yeah. But you don't know whatever really happens to this cookie, do you? It's still
serving, seen as a crime in the future, I suppose.
It's still serving its master to this day, probably.
Maybe. Because they exist forever, these consciousnesses.
Well, yeah. And obviously, it doesn't know, though. And it's his job to kind of convince it to submit, basically, because its job is to sort of just run the house and kind of make the toast in the morning, set the alarms, open the curtains. And
it reminds me of this Simpsons episode, like Treehouse of Horror.
Yeah.
Where it has Pierce Brosnan's voice in it. They have this, like, it's a great, like, I love Treehouse of Horror.
It's like
anyway.
A smart house.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. And it goes insane and falls in love with Marge, because of course.
Obviously.
And it's a bit,
she's a babe.
She is a babe. We talk about hot men through both of these podcasts. We talked about Nosedive in the same session, which might be weird to people who are listening to them separately. But she is a babe, and Pierce Brosnan's smart house falls in love with her. And I couldn't then get the Simpsons out of my head. And I was like, what if Greta's cookie goes nuts?
Yeah.
And actually, Matt Trent totally cracks onto Greta at the end. Did you catch that?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, what?
He does the line, doesn't he?
He does the line. Harry's, the line he gave to Harry.
You know, on the way into work today, Sookie, there was this man just riding a horse down the street, topless.
He was topless. Was it Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, what?
Because that was, again, what made me think. I was like, me too, totally. Because that is his jam.
It is his jam. He loves it.
It's his jam.
But,
if anything, it is.
But, yeah, so John Hamm's character, essentially, is training the cookie to do its job.
And
he tries, he has to break it because at first it won't submit. And, you know, she thinks that she's a person. And
is it really creepy seeing this dating guru who's really enjoyed far too much power then using his power over a part of a consciousness that thinks it's a woman?
I mean, he really kind of tortures her.
It's a lot like Robert Daly in Nanette.
Yeah.
In USS Callister.
Yeah.
What does he do to Greta's cookie that is not as bad as when Daly takes away Nanette's face?
Totally, yeah.
To make her submit.
It's real control, and it's aggressive control
really aggressive,
as well. And it's really cruel what he does to her. It is torture, essentially.
He says, oh, you can't, if you break them too much, you know, they're useless, these cookies. They're video game fodder. And they may well be in playtest. Men Against Fire, again, has quite a kind of video game element to it. Mm-hmm. And most of all, Metalhead, it makes me think, is Metalhead a simulated world? And is Maxine Peake's character Bella a broken cookie? Mm. Bless her heart.
I mean, that is a thing where it's similar in USS Callister, where these cookies are sort of generated. Stop laughing at the way I say cookie.
I love it. I wish I could.
Are these sort of generated, computer-generated versions of people don't know that they're not real.
Yeah.
And that's the saddest thing about it, because as far, you know, they've got all the memories of the person. They've got, you know, they think that they are the person. They don't understand. And obviously the person living on the real person living out there on the outside world has no idea what they're going through and what's happening to them. Because you see in USS Callister, don't you, that everyone who he's sort of taken and put in his game is just going about their lives as normal. They've got no idea that a version of themselves somewhere is being tortured, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's really sad to think that, you know, could you do it? If this was possible, to take this little bit of your consciousness and have it sort of slave over you and do everything for you, would you do it knowing that it was going to feel this way, but you wouldn't know because, so would it bother you?
And then, by the same token, Joe's cookie kind of betrays him by giving up the confession later on.
Yes.
And Joe has no idea. And when they go to his son and say, well, your cookie's done it for you.
Yeah.
So it could be a stand-in for you and give something that you weren't willing to give because of torture again.
Yeah.
It brings up so many interesting ideas, which you can then really see or explore much further in seasons 3 and 4. And for me, it's a real turning point from the Channel 4 ones, and White Christmas is the last one to go originally on Channel 4. It's like definitely the middle ground between Channel 4 ones and then what we look at in seasons 3 and 4. And the structure as well is so...
Yeah.
It breaks new ground.
It's a real foreshadowing to, like, where it's going. And obviously, like you say, this... what's happening with this cookie is what's going to happen with Joe. And we're still at this point don't know that.
We have no idea.
All we know is that he's telling this guy about his job, what he does. And the guy, the interesting thing about that is that he actually says, doesn't it, that's slavery.
Mm.
Little does he know it's happening
to him
right now.
And by this point, cookies don't have rights either. And we find out later, I think in Hated in the Nation, at the end of season 3, there's a ticker on a news thing saying cookies have human rights.
Mm-hmm.
Which it feels like they should.
Yeah, because they do. They believe they're human. They've got all the thoughts and memories that they have as the human they were and that they've come from. So it is very arguable. But
do you know what's interesting? It's just occurred to me is that it's a bit like how you decide if celebrities' children should be shown in a story. And how we work that out is a bit... it's kind of looking at what celebrities put out themselves.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And anyone's persona on social media isn't the real them, as we kind of discussed a little bit. Because it's the edited highlights of your life. But like a Rooney child, they put the children on social media that's accessible to the public quite often. Yeah. So it kind of feels okay to use a picture like that in a story, but then say David Tennant and his kids.
Yeah. There's certain celebrities that if there's like pap images of them with the child in the park, you know, it's you have to blur the child's face and I don't think there's really like kind of a hard and fast rule about it. It's just kind of a courtesy thing, really, because you know that that person doesn't put the child out there. Like you say, there's a lot of celebrities who do, and the social media is, and like the Kardashians, their kids are all on the show and everything. And we've watched most of them actually be born.
Yeah, Kylie Jenner grew up on that show and is now having.
Yeah, I mean, Kourtney Kardashian literally birthed all of her children on the show. And
yes, like I had to think about which one she was for a second. Sorry,
she's the older sister.
What rights to privacy do the children get to have? Like, they had no choices, did they?
Yeah, and obviously it's down to the parents, and they obviously have no issue with it. But yeah, the likes of David Tennant, who takes a much more private view to his children, and the way he and a lot of people look at things is that, you know, yeah, he's chosen to be in the public eye, but his children haven't and therefore shouldn't be until they come of a certain age when they may or may not decide whether to do that. And
no one knows what age that is either. Really, it should be 18, but obviously kids are given mobiles well before then. And it's such a... We're in an era where we haven't decided some important rights yet, and if the celebrity parent is the original human and the child is like the cookie, it is really complicated, and there isn't anything in law that says these children can be shown but these can't, or you have to pick like these. We kind of go by how private, how much a celebrity seems to value their privacy and the privacy of their children, and those are two separate things as well.
And there was an interesting thing with this recently, with Ewan McGregor's daughter, because she actually posted a video of herself playing a song that she'd allegedly written about her father on Instagram, a public Instagram page that we could all access and see. But when,
download, embed, etc.
But when we did a story on that, we blurred her face because Ewan McGregor has never put her out there, and she's under 18. So we blurred her face.
How even old is though, she now? She's 16.
I think she's about 16, yeah. So we blurred her image when we did the story for our website. But anybody, you know, you could have just gone on our Instagram page and seen it for yourself had you wanted to. But we did because, you know, he's always had that privacy element as well. So it's interesting how it works, because there isn't a hard and fast rule.
No.
And, you know, everyone, yes, is entitled to some element of privacy. But I think with a celebrity, you know, for example, a celebrity relationship, they put out there all these images, and the tweet about each other, the Instagram about each other, the flood the social media with pictures of them together. So when they break up and they suddenly expect nobody to write a story about it, you think, well, you made your relationship newsworthy. Do you know what I mean? It's the whole thing's a grey area, I suppose, really.
Yeah, in White Christmas, we see, I think, the beginnings of this kind of cruel, judgmental world.
Yeah, definitely. And I think where the blocking thing comes in for John Hamm's character, when he kind of... he has an argument with his wife, and she blocks him, doesn't she? And that sends him a bit crazy. And then that's kind of, that element of it's kind of put to one side for a while. And that doesn't come back until the third part.
It's very confident storytelling.
The third part of the episode, when Joe starts to open up about his life, and if you finally begin to learn about him. He didn't really understand where he was or why he was there, but you didn't know why, and it all sort of clicks into place at this point where the police haven't got a confession out of him. So they bring Matt Trent in. Matt's crime is a lesser crime. It was just getting him to get a confession out of this guy was a means to an end, wasn't it? And obviously, you know, we'll see that he gets his, he gets a punishment anyway.
He gets a horrifying sentence, Matrim. Yeah. To be blocked by the world and for them to see him as
a red.
Yeah. Slur.
He can't communicate with anyone. He can't see another person. In a way, it's what he did to the cookies to get them to submit to doing the job.
He'll either get attacked. I don't know if he can be physically attacked as a red.
I don't know if people block. Can touch you if you're blocked.
Because with a grey, obviously. Not well, no, the, I don't know. I don't, maybe people,
I think
touch
it's just seeing and hearing. I don't know if there's,
I think with a grey outline, you couldn't, like, you couldn't touch the person who blocked you, so don't know. And we don't actually find out what Joe's punishment is, but surely torture to get a confession is a war crime, usually, right? Is this happened in Iraq?
Definitely, but it's obviously they might argue it's not physical torture, is it?
Mental torture is still under the Geneva Convention.
Yeah,
it's,
I mean,
war crime.
It's just as bad, but...
So we've always stepped back into an age that of it's more primitive morality, definitely, even if the tech is futuristic.
Yeah.
And it made me think of White Bear. I've always hated White Bear, not as an episode or piece of storytelling, it's fantastic and fantastic acting, but in terms of what people are doing to Lenora Critchley's character, Victoria Skillane, and her name reverberates throughout Black Mirror, I find.
But yeah, I mean, you don't obviously find out what happens to actual Joe.
No.
But to little tiny consciousness Joe, he's obviously
a tiny cookie.
He's like a little cookie, isn't he? he ends up in what only can be described as never-ending torture.
You can look at it in a bleak way like that, or you can look at something like Black Museum and see that what I love about it is all the little criminological artifacts. So lots of bits like Victoria Scalane's mugshot is in there, Archangel tablet in there. It's that society has reassessed what it thinks these things mean. And on the day that it's 100 years since some women got the vote, that again is a sea change in how people view an entire sector of society. Are these people worthy of having votes or not? Mm-hmm. And thank goodness things do change, because you and I would not have a vote today if they didn't. It sometimes takes violent action, like Emmeline Pankhurst and suffragettes falling under a horse, or it's sometimes gradual. But yeah, I think Black Mirror goes to huge, important areas like social change, rights, philosophy, everything. It's almost too much to take in.
It is. And it is like... too much to, with episodes like this, it's too much to absorb on one sitting. And it's really interesting, I think, to watch it back once you know the ending, because then you want to watch for the clues and, like, was it there all along? And it's geniusly written, and the way it's acted and everything, to where the second time you watch it, you know it, that it was all there for you.
Yeah.
You just didn't see it the first time.
Yeah. It's so cleverly done. And I think it makes great use of the Netflix platform. We can go straight back to the beginning if you wanted to. We can go on to the next one or pause and come back in 3 days if you wanted. And with Channel 4, you had 4OD. But I think Netflix makes a kind of art out of the... I'll go back whenever I want and watch it. Me asking you, can you watch Nosedive? Can you watch White Christmas? You can go and find those episodes immediately if you subscribe to Netflix, which has become almost like standard for everyone.
Yeah.
And it's the beauty of it is, if every time you go back, there's something else to get from it. It's a fantastic episode. Thank you for listening to the podcast. That was White Christmas. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, subscribe, click all the stars, tell any cookies you might have languishing in your kitchen about this podcast. Make sure that your husband, who's locked away in his room at night doing really normal things on the computer, is listening to this podcast, nothing nefarious. And please don't block us.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. Thank you and bye.